In fact, if I remember correctly, he did spend some time in Macon, so he's right here close to where some of his roots are. We do welcome Dr. Davis. As you see in your brochure, he's on the faculty at Gordon-Conwell Seminary. He's come down from Boston for some warmer weather, and we provided with some cooler weather at night, although during the daytime it's been warming up nicely. He's probably as widely published, if not more widely published, in the area of ethics than any person that I've read. And again, I recommend his books highly. He has one back there, Your Wealth and God's World, which is an excellent summary. It's shorter than some others and easy to get through, so it's a good basic introduction to the biblical perspective on economics. But today he's going to talk with us on, you'll have to shift gears now. We've been dealing with terminal illness, with dying patients, with respirators and so forth. So shift gears, and we're going to talk about the other end of life, the problem with population, or is there a problem with population, and should we, as Christians, be involved with birth control? Jack?
Thank you, Dr. Payne, and fellow conferees. It is good to be back here in the South. For the last 12 years or so, my wife and I have been living in the greater Boston area, but I did grow up in Macon, Georgia. So the sight of red clay and pine trees is a welcome sight indeed. And I'm also glad to be a participant in this conference on medical ethics, an issue, of course, which has been very much in the forefront of the news and the American consciousness from the time of Karen Ann Quinlan to the more recent concern about the AIDS crisis. And of course, conferences on medical ethics aren't new on the American scene, but oftentimes conferences on medical ethics gather people from the medical community who may or may not be conversant with the philosophical and ethical tradition coming out of the Judeo-Christian stream in Western civilization. Or on the other hand, you may have gatherings of theologians and ethicists who aren't really in touch with the medical realities, which obviously are so relevant. And so I think what's very unique and helpful about this gathering is that we have representatives both from the medical community and also from the theological community who share a common biblical and theological frame of reference. So this is something of a first, but I certainly hope that it won't be the last in a series of gatherings of this sort in which Christians gather to reflect on some of the great challenges to the church in our time. I suppose my consciousness of the importance of medical ethics was first raised back in December of 1976 when I found myself marooned in the Philadelphia airport in December of that year, snowbound, and with a stack of the Human Life Review, a very fine publication in my hand. And as I read the Human Life Review, waiting for the next plane there, I was galvanized, really, by the magnitude of the abortion issue in the United States, an issue which I really had never given much attention to. So that impacted what I taught in the classroom. It led me to become involved in the Right to Life movement in the state of Massachusetts. For several years, I served as the chairman of the board of Massachusetts Citizens for Life. I was also involved in establishing a crisis pregnancy counseling center in a town nearby the seminary, and was also an elected delegate for Massachusetts for the White House Conference on Family. So I'm concerned about these issues both at the academic level, but also at the professional and the personal level. And so the issue that Dr. Payne asked me to address was world overpopulation and birth control. I'm sure a number of us may remember some 20 years ago when a best-selling book galvanized the attention of the American public, arguing that Western civilization, in fact, world civilization, was headed toward the brink of disaster. And we were, as it were, floundering in a rowboat without any oars heading toward the brink of Niagara Falls. A very dark and apocalyptic scenario, to be sure. The gentleman who wrote that book, of course, was Dr. Paul Ehrlich, the environmentalists of the University of California, and the book was The Population Bomb. And the apocalyptic scenario presented there by Dr. Ehrlich was a world literally breeding itself like rats into oblivion. And forceful measures had to be taken in order to preserve the human race from the population explosion. Well, some 20 years later, I think we're all aware of the fact that some of those predictions have failed to materialize. And yet, strangely enough, the pendulum has swung in a slightly different direction. And two decades after the publication of The Population Bomb, we have another best-selling book, which again paints a rather dire future for Western civilization. The book is The Birth Dearth, and the author is Ben Wattenberg. And again, we have a rather gloomy future predicted for Western civilization, but for exactly the opposite reason. Not overpopulation, but underpopulation, the birth dearth. The argument being that married couples, especially in the Western democratic and free societies, are simply not reproducing themselves such that we face a prospect in the intermediate and the longer term of the demise of Western civilization because of lower fertility rates. Well, I would like to address those issues as they bear especially, I think, upon our situation in the United States as American Christians of evangelical and reform conviction. But I'd like to reverse the order there of the topics announced in the bulletin there and first look at theological and moral issues relating to the issue of birth control and then the issue of population growth and family size as it affects us especially as American Christians in the 1980s. So first of all, I'd like to look at the development in Christian thinking about the matter of birth control, first from the Roman Catholic perspective and then from the Protestant perspective, and try to build a historical and theological foundation about a reality that is the practice of birth control, which is very frequently practiced, very commonly practiced, but rather, and surprisingly, infrequently discussed and reflected about in the Protestant churches. And we will see here that there is one core idea in the Catholic tradition, namely that of natural revelation, or the law of nature, which has shaped the thinking in the Roman Catholic tradition. And then we're going to look at another key concept, that of personal responsibility as a consequence of our creation in the image and likeness of God, which has been, as it were, the master idea or concept in Protestant and evangelical and Reformed thinking. And I'm going to try to develop a rationale from an evangelical and Reformed perspective on the matter of birth control. And then I'm going to offer a proposition or a thesis, okay, relating to family planning and family size in our American context here, which I think cuts against the grain not only of the thinking in the world, but oftentimes against the thinking in the Christian church. So that's where we're heading. Okay, first of all, let's look at the development of Roman Catholic thinking on the matter of birth control. And obviously, this is a tradition which has had tremendous influence and tremendous consequences for world population, for matters of wealth and poverty, and the human future. I think we have to understand the development of the Roman Catholic understanding of birth control against the background of historical and cultural realities in the first and second and third centuries in the Greco-Roman world, and realize that the Catholic Church of that day was reacting against many cultural trends which bear surprising similarities to cultural trends that we see in the United States in the 1980s. What are they? The Catholic Church was born into a world in which adultery, in which divorce, in which abortion, in which the practice of infanticide, in which the reality of declining fertility rates in the middle and upper middle class Roman society were very common. The church was living in a society in which voluntary childlessness, that is the decision simply not to have any children at all, was fairly common. And in the face of such social trends, the church came down very hard. It strongly affirmed not only the sanctity of the marriage bond, but also the duty of procreation as a divine calling and divine obligation for all married Christians. For example, one early church father, Clement of Alexandria, came down real hard on this. He said that even in that, for couples to have sexual relations in marriage for some other purpose other than to procreate children is to do injury to nature. Here's one of the earliest mentions here that, as a matter of fact, the order of nature is in fact a revelation of God's moral purpose in this matter. Okay. Clement and other Christian writers of the period were responding not only to tendencies in pagan society to deny the procreated dimensions of marriage, but also to Christian Gnostics who were also denying the role of procreation in marriage, or who were taking very libertine views of what Christian freedom in sexual matters meant. Now, surely the most single influential figure in setting the basic direction of the Catholic tradition in these matters was St. Augustine, who died in the year 430, whose theological influence has been massive not only in the Catholic tradition, but also in the Protestant tradition as well. Now, according to St. Augustine, marital relations, in order to be entirely free from the stain of sin, had to have procreation in view. According to Augustine, since original sin, which we all inherit from Adam, was transmitted from generation to generation through sexual intercourse, then the concupiscence, or the sexual desire involved in the act, had to be balanced by the positive good of an intent to procreate. Otherwise, Augustine believed that sexual intercourse, even within marriage, would be venially sinful. An intent to prevent procreation through the use of contraception, according to Augustine, turned the bridal chamber into a brothel. And husbands and wives who used, quote, poisons of sterility, that is, abortifacient drugs, to systematically exclude contraception or conception, were not joined in matrimony, but in seduction. So Augustine thus formed a strong presumption in Catholic teaching against contraception by combining elements from Stoicism, their view of the natural law, and from the Old Testament, and his own personal reaction to trends both in his past, his pre-Christian past, and in pagan Roman society. And Augustine's thinking was to set the course of Catholic thinking in such matters for centuries to come, and in some sense, still sets the tone in Catholic thinking in the 20th century. Now, however, during the Middle Ages, there were Catholic thinkers who tended to balance the somewhat, I think, one-sided and pessimistic assessment of marriage and human sexuality, as articulated by Augustine. For example, during the Middle Ages, William of Auxerre, who lived during the 13th century, taught that the good of one's offspring meant not only their procreation, but also their education and their nurture as rational and spiritual beings. William of Auxerre here was trying to articulate what we might consider a more holistic understanding of the ultimate goal of procreation within Christian marriage, and say that there are other goods in addition to, certainly not exclusive of, but in addition to procreation per se, but it's the total well-being of the person to be procreated, their educational, their moral, their emotional, and their spiritual well-being. Well, that particular idea was to evolve and develop over the centuries here, and was to have some impact in 20th century thinking about procreation, and yet the 20th century manifested also continuity with the basic Augustinian position. For example, in 1930, Pope Pius XI issued the encyclical Casti Canubi, The State of Marriage, which was a major papal declaration on the nature of Christian marriage as understood in the Catholic tradition. And this particular pronouncement was prompted by a number of factors, including a recent vote of the Anglican bishops in England, in which the bishops very cautiously affirmed the legitimacy of artificial means of contraception. It was also a response to discussions in Germany in the Catholic Church for changes in the traditional Catholic teaching. And it was also a response to a growing sense that at the parish level, the Catholic priests were simply not enforcing and teaching the Church's teaching. Well, in this particular encyclical, Pius the 11th steadfastly assumed the traditional ban against contraception. And Pius the 11th said, quote, "Any use whatever of marriage, in the exercise of which the act by human effort is deprived of its natural power of procreating life, violates the law of God and nature, and those who do such things are stained by a grave and mortal flaw." End of quote. So here again, the basic principle which has dominated Catholic thinking is that the law of nature itself indicates that the proper use of the organs of generation is to generate new life. And just as God created the stomach to digest food, so God created the human reproductive organs within marriage to procreate new life. That therefore to prohibit that natural activity here is to oppose the will of God as it is revealed in the natural order. And so that's the constant teaching of the Church from the first century, as it were, to the 20th century. However, Pius XI did introduce a slightly new dimension here by making reference to the use of sterile periods within marriage. And the sentence is this, quote, "Nor are those considered as acting against nature who in their married life use their right in the proper manner, although on account," here it is, "although on account of natural reasons or time or of certain defects, new life cannot be brought forth." Because of natural defects or because of time, new life cannot be brought forth. Now that was an ambiguous sentence. And for the next 30 years or so, Catholic theologians debated that reference to time. Did he mean that, well, it's okay to have sexual intercourse in cases where both the husband and wife are beyond the time of procreation here? Or does he talk about what later was called the rhythm method? It wasn't clear. Well, those ambiguities were resolved in a 1951 address by Pope Pius XII to the Italian Catholic Society of Midwives, in which he said, quote, "It follows that observance of the sterile period can be licit. In other words, the rhythm method is all right." This position represented a significant development in Catholic thinking beyond that of Augustine, one that had in fact been maturing for centuries. Now, the next major pronouncement from the Vatican came on July the 25th, 1968. The papal encyclical Humanae Vitae, of Human Life, by Pope Paul VI. And many people in the Church and around the world had expected a major shift in the Church's teaching at this point, because as a matter of fact, the Papal Commission, which had been appointed by the Pope to advise him in this matter, the majority of the Commission had in fact wanted the Pope to come out in favor of the legitimacy of artificial contraception, but those hopes were dashed and disappointed. The Pope stated, and I quote, "While observance of natural rhythms is legitimate, the Church, calling men back to the observance of the norms of the natural law," there it is again, "as interpreted by their constant doctrine, teaches that each and every marital act must remain open to the transmission of life." End of quote. And that essentially is where the Church remains in a statement of 1981, Pope John Paul II. Reaffirm the teaching of Humanae Vitae and the Church's ban on all artificial means of contraception. All right, so that's something of a sketch of Catholic thinking in this area. What about the developments in Protestant theology? And here you will see that perhaps the fundamental idea is an appeal to personal responsibility as a consequence of our creation in the image and likeness of God, such that the use of artificial means of contraception may, in certain instances, represent a morally responsible choice of those who were created in the image and likeness of God. All right, now, in many important respects, the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century did not represent a dramatic or even a significant break with the thinking of the Catholic Church on matters relating to marriage and procreation. Because obviously a lot of the new technological means of artificial contraception were not an issue in the 16th century. Luther and Calvin, for example, and other Protestant reformers nowhere give explicit endorsement to what would be considered modern attitudes toward contraception. However, there were new aspects of their understanding of marriage and sexuality which were to be later developed. For example, marriage was no longer considered to be a sacrament of the church, but an order of creation. Mandatory priestly celibacy was repudiated as being out of accordance with the scriptures, and companionship in marriage was given new emphasis as part of God's fundamental purpose for Christian marriage, not denying the centrality or the importance of procreation, but also balancing that with the desire for the development of human persons within that relationship under the aspect of companionship. But it was not well into the 20th century that any major Protestant body publicly affirmed the moral legitimacy of artificial contraception. And, for example, in 1925, the bishops of the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States rejected the moral legitimacy of artificial means of contraception, as it had done earlier in 1908 and 1920, bishops of the Anglican Church in England. However, in 1930, the bishops of the Church of England broke with the past and became the first major Protestant body in history to make a cautious affirmation of the moral legitimacy of artificial contraception. And the statement runs as follows. Where there is a clearly felt moral obligation to limit or avoid parenthood, the method must be decided on Christian principles. Where there is a morally sound reason for avoiding complete abstinence, the conference agrees that other methods may be used, provided this is done in light of the same Christian principles. The conference records its strong condemnation of the use of any methods of conception control from motives of selfishness, luxury, or mere convenience. Now that's a rather cautious and frankly a rather vague step in that direction. It really doesn't develop a fully articulated biblical rationale for the use of artificial contraception. And it was not until the 1950s and the 1960s that major Protestant bodies in this country and also around the world affirmed artificial contraception. And it wasn't until 1969 that any body of conservative Protestant scholars really directly addressed this issue. In 1969, a group of evangelical Protestant scholars issued an affirmation on the control of human reproduction, in which they tried to develop a theological rationale for birth control. Well, with that as something of a historical sketch here, I would like to survey very briefly here some biblical principles and also biblical texts here which I think directly should inform evangelical and reformed thinking on the matter of birth control. We recall that, of course, from the very beginning, mankind is given the mandate to be fruitful and multiply and to fill the earth and to subdue it. Okay, the so-called cultural mandate found in the first chapter of Genesis. And that mandate to procreate as a reflection on earth of God's own creative activity is found not only in Genesis 1, but is repeated to Noah and to his sons after the flood in Genesis 9. It's also an important feature of God's covenant with Abraham. Okay, in Genesis 15, Genesis 17, Genesis 22, it's repeated to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob on various occasions. And insofar as God's covenant with Abraham is really the backbone of the Bible and the backbone of God's redemptive plan from Genesis to Revelation, that certainly is very central to the biblical outlook as a whole. You certainly recall those statements in the Psalms, which display a very positive outlook on childbirth in childbearing. Psalms 127 and 128. Lo, sons are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, the psalmist says in Psalm 127:3, a statement here which certainly is in great distinction to many attitudes which we find in 20th century American culture. The psalmist says, the family that fears God will be blessed. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your wife will be your children like olive shoots around your table. Thus shall the man be blessed who fears God. Psalm 128. So it's very evident that in Hebrew culture, childbearing was considered a blessing, and infertility was considered a curse. And the Old Testament closes on this very same note, with the prophet Malachi reminding the Israelites of his day that the Lord desires what? A godly offspring. Malachi 2:15. Now, in the New Testament, the Hebrew emphasis on procreation and childbirth is still there. It's perhaps somewhat modified, though not abandoned or denied, by a recognition that some Christians are called to celibacy, that they have that gift. And so you find perhaps a greater place for that within the New Covenant community than is evident within the Old Covenant community. And yet, basically, there's still that Hebrew emphasis that children are a blessing of the Lord, and that under most circumstances, Christian men and Christian women within the state of marriage should see as a divine duty to raise up a godly seed. For example, 1 Timothy 5:18 is a text which points in that direction, I believe. The Apostle Paul admonishes the younger widows, for example, to do what? To remarry, to bear children, and to rule their households in order to maintain a good Christian witness to the wider world. I think that's a very significant statement here, because here in the New Covenant, here in the New Testament, here in the church age after Pentecost, Paul still presupposes that the creation mandate, first announced in Genesis chapter 1, reaffirmed in the covenant with Noah, reaffirmed in the Abrahamic covenant, is still personally and theologically relevant to the Christian family. Very interesting. So to make a long story short here, it would appear that there is really no explicit endorsement of artificial contraception in either the Old Testament or the New Testament. It's very pronatalist in its general outlook. And that general direction has caused some people of evangelical and reformed persuasion to say that, well, look, there's no good argument for the use of artificial contraception within Christian marriage. If you really believe in the sovereignty of God, you should simply let God make the decision about how many children you're going to have. And I respect the people who hold that position and also the grounds upon which they make it. However, as you know, there's another point of view within Christian circles. And here the fundamental idea and the fundamental principle upon which the alternative position is based is that of the image of God. All human beings, certainly all Christians, are made in the image and likeness of God. And what follows from that biblical teaching? Well, it certainly means that men and women are different not only in degree but also in kind from the rest of God's creation and from the rest of the animal kingdom. If we believe that we're made in the image and likeness of God, then men and women are not simply part of nature, okay, but we are called to be responsible rulers and stewards and managers of nature, including our own human nature, on God's behalf. I think one thing that follows from that is that human beings, as conscious beings made in God's image, are to direct all of their powers and abilities, including their procreative ones, toward their appointed goals with the guidance of the principles revealed in Scripture. In other words, what I'm arguing here is that man's calling is not simply, quote, to let nature take its course, okay, but to consciously redirect and manage nature toward the fulfillment of the divine plan. What I'm saying is that just as God himself created the human race and also recreated a fallen human race according to a conscious plan, so it follows that men and women, as God's representative on earth, should imitate God by exercising all of their abilities, including their procreative abilities, according to a conscious plan. Well, that is my basic argument. God did not create by a blind act of will or passion, neither should those made in his image. God is the great planner. in his creative work, and therefore men and women made in his image, I think, should also plan and manage and exercise stewardly responsibility as we reflect God's own wisdom. So it might be argued then that contraception could be justified in terms of the general teaching of Scripture according to the nature of man in Christian marriage. So Catholics and Protestants both recognize, on the one hand, the revelation of God's will in the natural order, and on the other hand, human responsibility, but different weight is assigned to those factors in the two traditions. And so I recognize here that the order of creation is a revelation of God's will, but I also realize that God calls me as his image and likeness here to discern his will in the particular circumstances within the moral guidelines that are outlined to us in the Bible. And while it's true, for example, to advert to an earlier illustration here, that nature itself tells me that my stomach was created by God to digest food, other aspects of biblical revelation also tell me that it may be God's will for me to deny for a moment for a higher moral and spiritual good the natural operation of my stomach upon food, i.e. fasting. Okay? It may be morally right under those circumstances to intervene, as it were, in the natural order to make a responsible choice for a higher spiritual good, which in fact is recognized in the Bible. All right, now I'd like to pass on to the second major issue, and that's the issue of world population growth, especially as it affects American Christians in the 1980s. And the thesis that I want to argue is this, and I think it cuts against the grain not only of secular society, but also I think a lot of thinking in the Christian church. My proposition is this. I believe that in the 20th century, that in our present cultural situation, I believe that American Christians of childbearing age should be encouraged to have larger than average families. Right. Now, keep in mind everything that I've said about, I think, the moral legitimacy within marriage of artificial means of contraception. I'm saying something else different. Now, I'm going to argue here that there are good and sufficient reasons why, in our situation, American Christians, I'm not talking about someone in Bangladesh or in Calcutta, but I'm going to argue here that there are good and sufficient reasons why American Christians in the 1980s should be encouraged. I'm not talking about legislation. I'm going to argue here that American Christians in the 1980s should be encouraged to consider to have slightly larger than average families. And I'm going to define a slightly larger than average family here in our historical situation is more than two kids. Okay, why do I say this? For a number of reasons. Well, as you know, here in the United States, the post-war baby boom has turned into the baby bust. U.S. fertility rates have been trending generally downward since 1800, but the process began accelerating in 1921. During the 1950s, the fertility rate for American couples reached a high point for the century, 3.8 children per woman, but then began to decline dramatically. By the year 1976, the nation's bicentennial, the fertility rate had plummeted to fewer than 1.8 births per woman, the lowest rate in history, and has hovered around 1.8 children per woman for about the last 15 years, in other words, below replacement level. And given the present attitudes among American women concerning childbirth, it does not seem likely that the low fertility rates that have characterized the past few decades will be dramatically reversed. I also would argue here that the reality of the birth dearth, as Wattenberg has posed it here, does have serious social and economic implications, not only for the American future, but also should be part of our thinking in terms of the church's mission to the world and Christian discipleship and the fulfillment of God's kingdom purposes for our age. Not only in American culture, but throughout Western Europe, fertility rates have been plummeting since the Second World War. For example, the population of West Germany is shrinking, It's actually declining by 3,000 people a week. 3,000 people a week. And some scholars are now concerned that West Germany, for example, will not be able to fulfill its NATO responsibilities because there simply aren't enough young West Germans in order to fill the army ranks. And so here you have a West German society that says we do not want to defend ourselves through nuclear arms. Let's do it by conventional means. Where are the soldiers going to come from? We are now facing demographic realities where in Italy, the home of the Vatican, today in Italy there are more people dying in Italy than are being born in Italy. That tells you something about the practice of artificial contraception in the homeland of Roman Catholicism. American fertility rates have plunged 54% in the last 19 years. Today there are 3 million fewer Americans aged 16 to 24 now available to enter the workplace than there were in 1980. And I don't know how that's affecting the service industries and fast food industries right here, but in my part of the country, Taco Bell, that the mall is having to offer $7 an hour for people to serve tacos in order to attract any teenagers to do those work, that type of work. And a Burger King near where I live had to close for several weeks because they couldn't find anyone to serve hamburgers at $6 an hour. Had to close up. They're now reopening. Now, I realize that closing down the Burger King is not the end of the world. And if that is the least of my worries, I think there are more serious things to think about, such as the Social Security system. Perhaps you're aware of the fact that a couple of years ago in 1985, the ratio of people paying into Social Security and those drawing out was 5-1. Five workers paying into every retiree drawing out. Well, given present fertility rates here, and by the year 2035, when today's baby boomers are going to be retiring, the ratio is going to be 2.5-1. Now, what's that going to do either to Social Security benefits or to the levels of taxation that are needed to sustain pleasant level of benefits? I think the arithmetic is rather self-evident. Heavier tax burdens are a surefire recipe for social conflict. And I think that Peter Drucker, a very astute observer of social trends, is correct when he says this: the conflict between older and younger people, rather than between management and labor, will be the central social conflict in our culture over the next 50 years. I think there's reason to be concerned about that. And so the lower fertility trends, which also imply that the United States is an aging society, also has very serious trends beyond Social Security. Older people, on the average, tend to require more medical care than do young people. And with a higher proportion of older people in the population, that means greater medical cost for the society as a whole. And the problem, as you know, is exacerbated both by increasing lifespans and by the higher cost of high-tech medical technology. The shrinking number of young people aged 15 to 24 also has implications for the armed forces. Most people would prefer that we have an all-volunteer armed services. Well, if you have a shrinking pool available for enlistment in the armed services, if you don't want to go back to the draft, you're going to need to offer higher salaries to a shrinking pool of recruits, which that also means higher costs for society. So neither a reinstitution of the draft nor a greatly increased budget to support an all-volunteer armed force is socially appealing or politically popular. Now let me address some other, I think, widely held misconceptions about population growth and population density. Professor Paul Ehrlich and many of his followers here spread the idea that population growth is a cancer eating away at the very soul of the human race, because population growth contributes to, if it does not cause directly, such social ills as poverty, pollution, and crime. And I stand here to tell you today that I think that connection is simplistic at best, if not downright false in many cases. I believe an examination of selected nations around the world will show that this assumption that population growth in and of itself leads to pollution, to poverty, and to crime is rather simplistic. Consider the Netherlands, for example. The Netherlands has a population density 17 times that of the United States, 1,002 persons per square mile versus 64 persons per square mile in the United States. And yet I think it's rather obvious that the people of Holland enjoy a rather high quality of life. On the other hand, Afghanistan, with a population density of 56 persons per square mile, though lower than that of the United States, has and had a far lower standard of living even prior to the Soviet invasion than the United States. It's simply not the case that high population density leads to poverty and that low population densities lead to prosperity. The issues are far more complex. There are many factors: social values, religious traditions, attitudes toward work, attitudes toward the family, levels of education, and technological sophistication. All of that has a far greater impact on per capita income within a nation than does population density per se. South Korea, for example, with a population density of 973 people per square mile, almost twice that of India, has at the same time a higher per capita income. And South Korea, as you know, of course, has become a real dynamo in the area of high technology. And highly populated societies such as Singapore, Taiwan, and Hong Kong are becoming leaders in the world of high-tech manufacturing. And there are lonely voices in the world of American demographics, such as that of Professor Julian Simon, and I think a land-breaking work here, Population Growth, the Advantages, who points out people bring not only mouths and hands into the world, but also heads and brains, and the possibility of creative solutions. He says additional persons can be, under the right circumstances, the source of technological advance by inventing, by adapting, and by diffusing new forms of productive knowledge. Japan is a good case in point. Japan's high population density, 810 people per square mile, over 12 times that of the United States, is an asset rather than a liability in the new high-tech world of an information society. Japan's highly educated, highly energetic people are, I believe, a real asset in its drive to become the world leader in the race for a fifth-generation supercomputer, for example. Population growth under the right conditions can create new business opportunities, new markets, and can facilitate change. It can make expansion of investments more attractive by reducing risks and by increasing the total demand for goods and services. Larger population leads to economies of scale that can make large-scale social investments such as highways, bridges, railroads, school systems, and ports less costly on a per-person basis. Well, what might this mean for us as 20th century Christians, especially those of us who may still be of childbearing age, or may have an occasion to influence those who are still making these decisions? Well, my conviction is this, namely that Christians in America who have larger families and who raise and disciple their children well are making a contribution of great significance both to society and to the kingdom of God. That is my belief. Such Christian families, producing young people of such character and diligence who can contribute to the solution of difficult problems in our society — we're not thinking only of the Social Security system and other facets of American life — but Christians who have larger families are also contributing, let's remember, to the expansion of God's kingdom in the world. Humanists who consistently practice the zero population growth philosophy, as did many of the middle and upper middle classes in the ancient Roman world, are literally breeding themselves out of existence, as are many people in American culture. According to Ben Wattenberg, the average number of children in American families in which the household income is $35,000 a year or greater is 1.3 children. 1.3 children being the average number of children in American households where the family income is $35,000 a year or more. He doesn't break that down, of course, according to religious orientation, but that's a highly significant social statistic, I believe. Christians, on the other hand, who have a philosophy of positive population growth, may, under the blessings of God, achieve a position of cultural influence over the course of several generations. What am I saying here? I'm saying here that even though we may affirm the legitimacy of artificial means of contraception, there is such a thing as overreacting to certain Roman Catholic teachings about contraception and family size that we have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And I realize, certainly, that in the 1980s in this culture, it's not cheap, either in time or money, to have children. My wife and I have four, as a matter of fact, so I think I'm trying to practice what I'm preaching to you here today. But I'm saying this is one of the great undiscussed issues in the Christian church. When have you heard a sermon? When have you heard a Sunday school class in which any preacher or theologian has attempted to meddle in your private affairs and raise the matter as a matter of spiritual and biblical concern, this issue of family size? It's one of the great undiscussed issues in the Christian church. And so here I am to challenge you to give some thought along those lines as I challenge my own seminary students. American evangelicals are quite aware, at least in principle, of the biblical mandate of the Great Commission, Matthew 28. I believe they need to rediscover the relevance of the cultural mandate to be fruitful and to multiply, because I believe that God wants His kingdom on earth to expand both through evangelism, but also through the raising up of a godly seed, Malachi 2:15.
Quick survey, there are an average of 4.3 children per speaker. I personally believe that God is moving in this area, even with the dearth of preaching. As I observe Christian families around the country there, it's very common to have 3, 4, 5, and even more children. I'll not name the numbers from all the speakers, but that's the average.
That's true. I think in Reformed circles, it seems to me that, especially in recent years, the numbers do seem to be moving in that direction. And I think that Christian families who do move in that direction do need some encouragement and some inspiration, because oftentimes everything our culture says is basically lays a guilt trip on you are being socially and morally irresponsible, you know, by having more than two children. And I think that's both bad demographics and also bad theology. So I just think that needs to be said. And so I was here this morning to say it.